From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Barely 6 weeks after his apparent selection for the job by U.S. officials was exposed in a now-famous intercepted phone call, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, the man who is now the acting Prime Minister of Ukraine, was hosted by President Barack Obama at the White House Wednesday.
It is a pleasure to welcome Prime Minister Yatsenyuk to the Oval Office, to the White House. I think all of us have seen the courage of the Ukrainian people in standing up on behalf of democracy and on the desire that I believe is universal for people to be able to determine their own destiny. And we saw in the Maidan how ordinary people from all parts of the country had said that we want to change. The Prime Minister was part of that process, showed tremendous courage, and upheld the principles of nonviolence throughout the course of events over the last several months. Obviously, the Prime Minister comes here during a very difficult time for his country. In the aftermath of President Yanukovych leaving the country, the Parliament, the Rada, acted in a responsible fashion to fill the void, created a inclusive process in which all parties had input, including the party of former President Yanukovych. They have set forward a process to stabilize the country, take a very deliberate step to assure economic stability and negotiate with the International Monetary Fund, and to schedule early elections so that the Ukrainian people, in fact, can choose their direction for the future. And the Prime Minister has managed that process with great skill and great restraint, and we're very much appreciative of the work that he has done. The most pressing challenge that Ukraine faces at the moment, however, is the threat to its territorial integrity and its sovereignty. We have been very clear that we consider the Russian incursion into Crimea outside of its bases to be a violation of international law, of international agreements of which Russia is a signatory, and a violation of the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. And we have been very firm in saying that we will stand with Ukraine and the Ukrainian people in ensuring that that territorial integrity and sovereignty is maintained. I think we all recognize that there are historic ties between Russia and Ukraine, and I think the Prime Minister would be the first one to acknowledge that. And I think the Prime Minister and the current government in Kiev has recognized and has communicated directly to the Russian Federation their desire to try to manage through this process diplomatically. But what the Prime Minister, I think, has rightly insisted on is that they cannot have a country outside of Ukraine dictate to them how they should arrange their affairs, and that there is a constitutional process in place and a set of elections that they can move forward on that, in fact, could lead to different arrangements over time with the Crimean region. But that is not something that can be done with the barrel of a gun pointed at you. And so Secretary Kerry is in communications with the Russian government and has offered to try to explore with his counterpart, Foreign Minister Lavrov, a diplomatic solution to this crisis. We are in close communication with the Ukrainian government in terms of how we might proceed going forward. But we will continue to say to the Russian government that if it continues on the path that it is on, then not only us, but the international community, the European Union, and others will be forced to apply a cost to Russia's violations of international law and its encroachments on Ukraine. There's another path available, and we hope that President Putin is willing to seize that path. But if he does not, I'm very confident that the international community will stand strongly behind the Ukrainian government in preserving its unity and its territorial integrity. Let me just make two final points. Obviously, because of the political turmoil, the economic situation in Ukraine has become more challenging, not less. And that's why I'm very proud that not only as critical members of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, we are working with the Prime Minister and his team in a package that can help to institute necessary reforms inside of the Ukraine, but also help to stabilize the situation so that people feel confident that in their daily lives they can meet their basic necessities. We're also asking Congress to act promptly to deliver on an aid package, including a $1 billion loan guarantee, that can help smooth the path for reform inside of Ukraine and give the Prime Minister and his government the capacity to do what they need to do as they are also organizing an election process. So I would just ask both Democrats and Republicans, who I know are unified in their support of Ukraine, to move quickly, to give us the support that we need so that we can give the Ukrainian people the support that they need. And then finally, Mr. Prime Minister, I would ask that you deliver a message on behalf of the American people to all the Ukrainian people, and that is that we admire their courage, we appreciate their aspirations, the interests of the United States are solely in making sure that the people of Ukraine are able to determine their own destiny. That is something that here in the United States we believe in deeply. I know it's something that you believe in deeply as well, and you can rest assured that you will have our strong support as you move forward during these difficult times.
In his debut before the world press, Yatsenyuk channeled the ghost of Ronald Reagan.
My message to President Putin, Mr. Putin, tear down this wall, the wall of war, intimidation, and military aggression.
Yatsenyuk was scheduled to speak before the UN Security Council late Thursday. Not mentioned by the president or U.S. corporate media was the recent revelation of a recording of Catherine Ashton, the foreign minister of the EU, and Estonia's foreign minister, acknowledging that the sniper attacks on protesters and police at the Maidan, which led to the takeover of Ukraine's government, were, in fact, working with protest leaders who are now recognized by Washington as Ukraine's government. Press TV filed this report.
Ukraine's former security chief confirms as true the allegations that the snipers who killed dozens of people in last month's anti-government protests operated from a building controlled by the opposition. Alexander Yakimenko says the building on Maidan Square was under the full control of Andrei Paruby. The opposition figure was appointed as Secretary of the National Security and Defense Council of Ukraine after the opposition took power in Ukraine. The former chief of Ukraine's security service believes Paruby has been in contact with U.S. special forces and they may have arranged the deadly shootings. Meanwhile, Russia has called for the formation of an independent group to investigate the crimes committed by the extremists and armed elements of the opposition over the past 3 months. Let's speak to a radio host with a voice of Russia, Dmitry Babich. What do you make of these comments coming out right now, first of all? These are quite revealing, wouldn't you agree?
I agree, and I would say that the first impulse for the investigation, it came from a recorded conversation between the Estonian foreign minister and the chief of European diplomacy, Catherine Ashton. During that conversation, which was secretly recorded, the Estonian minister told how he talked to some of the Maidan activists who actually acknowledged that people on both sides during the riots in Kiev were killed by the same bullets, and that these bullets did not come from Yanukovych's forces, but from some of the elements of the opposition. I would remind you that Andrei Paluby, who was the so-called commandant of Maidan and who indeed controlled the building of Symphony from which these shots were fired. So this Andrei Paluby, in the beginning of 1990s, founded the so-called National Social Party of Ukraine. Its program was purely National Socialist. You can guess that in Ukraine, which suffered from the Nazis, people know very well what National Social means and what National Socialist means. So he is a pure Nazi. If you read his opinions, if you read his articles of 20, 15 years ago, you can see that he doesn't conceal even his views on Jews, for example. So basically, you can expect anything from this kind of person. And it's very unfortunate that he now heads the National Security Council of Ukraine. Later, this National Social Party of Ukraine became Svoboda, which means freedom in Russian and Ukrainian. And now Svoboda controls 4 seats in the Ukrainian government. And the prosecutor general is also a member of this Svoboda, formerly the National Social Party of Ukraine. And this person can arrest anyone in Ukraine within minutes.
Indeed, Mr. Babich, as you just pointed out, this is a government that has neo-Nazi elements within it. It is a government that came to power through, as mounting evidence is showing, using snipers against the civilian population, being in a contact with U.S. special forces. Now, there are many elements within Ukraine and outside that have been questioning the legitimacy of this interim government in Kiev. Do you think with more evidence such as the one we see today, this legitimacy will be questioned on a larger scale and on a larger platform?
Well, I would not comment on Mr. Paruby's connections to U.S. special forces. I honestly don't know. But it's enough to read the programs of the parties which now control the Ukrainian government. It's enough to read their interviews. You can find them in the internet. You can translate them from Ukrainian and from Russian. And these are indeed neo-Nazi views. This is for certain. You don't need to make any investigations to find it out. So it's really unfortunate that obviously this government gets support from the United States and from the European Union right now. The leaders of Western countries shut their eyes to the real convictions of these people now in power in Ukraine. They don't listen to Russia, just like they haven't been listening to Iran for 34 years. And, you know, it's very unfortunate, but I think that even this situation in Crimea, which I don't like, to be frank with you, it was the result of this blocking of dialogue between Russia and the United States, Russia and the EU. Russia was simply not listened, just like Iran is not being listened right now. And this is a very dangerous situation when communication is blocked.
Indeed, Mr. Babich, very, very quickly, if you can, my next question was about the situation in Crimea and whether these revelations are going to have an effect on what's happening there.
I'm afraid that these revelations are going to be rejected by the new Ukrainian government. Of course, this government won't allow any investigation because there is already a myth created around Maidan. This is a Ukrainian nationalist myth about heroes who died, terrible death in the hands or under the bullets of butchers. The same kind of myth was created about the Ukrainian nationalist fighters who helped Hitler, occupy Ukraine in 1940s, and later these fighters fought the Soviet army. So there is that heroic myth created around them, although these people had really dubious convictions, to put it mildly. So in order not to destroy that myth, the new Ukrainian government will not investigate the allegations that indeed the bullets could come from elements connected to the opposition.
Meanwhile, as the U.S. professes the primacy of the principles of democracy and non-interference in the Ukraine, last month marked the 10th anniversary of the second U.S.-orchestrated coup d'etat in the Caribbean nation of Haiti in as many decades, and they tried to do it again in 2010. Glenn Ford, executive editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, spoke with Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington about the direct role of the U.S. in serial regime change in Haiti.
It's been 10 years since the United States backed a coup in Haiti and then drove its democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, into exile in Africa. Now it's been revealed that 6 years later, in 2010, the U.S. and its allies proposed to drive another Haitian president, René Préval, out of office and out of the country. That story has not seen the light of day in most of the U.S. corporate media.
No, it hasn't. And what you refer to, we know from revelations made by the OAS special rep to Haiti at the time, Ricardo Seitenfuss, this threatened removal of Préval on a plane, as it was put to Préval. This came actually directly from the head of the UN mission down in Haiti, which we know from State Department cables made available by WikiLeaks, the U.S. government sees as a way to manage Haiti on the cheap, essentially. So, you know, we can clearly see the U.S. hand behind this threat as well. The U.S. ambassador to Haiti at the time was in a private meeting of something they call the core group, a secretive group of foreign power brokers in Haiti, and clearly also was, according to Seitenfuss, was in favor of this threat to remove Préval. This is definitely a hugely important story, and it's a real shame that the major media outlets don't seem to be giving it any attention.
So here we have the United States forcing into exile one president of Haiti in 2004, and then 6 years later proposing to do the same thing to another. That's rather high-handed even for a superpower like the United States.
It is, but, you know, it comes out of a long tradition. I mean, you have over 200 years. This year is the 210th anniversary of Haiti's independence. During that whole history, the U.S. has been interfering in Haiti's affairs, along with France, of course, the imperial power that Haiti got its independence from. So this kind of intervention has never really stopped. It's been the U.S., France, and Canada who've continued to muddle on Haiti's affairs, try to control what's happening there, and in particular control the people of Haiti. So direct assault on democracy and popular will we've seen expressed over and over again with the elections of Aristide twice by great majorities of people. Of course, Préval, seen, I think, by many with a lot of legitimacy, is not as progressive of a president as Aristide, but he was elected in 2006 when Aristide's Famille-Lavalas party was not allowed on the ballot due to, again, outside foreign intervention. At the time, Famille-Lavalas is essentially seen as an illegal party. It's practically driven underground, persecuted, its leaders imprisoned on bogus charges under the post-coup government that was installed on Haiti by Washington. And so you saw Préval come to office in kind of a surprise to Washington election by, again, a great number of people because, you know, this was the best choice they had without Famille-Lavalas on the ballot. Then again, you see before his term is over, the same foreign powers threatening to remove him by force. And Préval, according to Seitenfuss, told them that he is not Aristide, he is Salvador Allende. This is a reference to, you know, of course, the coup in Chile, where Allende stayed in the presidential palace to the end, supposedly committed suicide. Préval made clear he wasn't going to be thrown out. Seitenfuss's revelation here is very interesting, too, and he shows that it was really Brazil and Argentina diplomats from those countries that stopped this coup in the making from happening.
Yes, this puts Préval in a somewhat different light, or possibly a heroic light, in that he was marked for expulsion and exile and stood up to the superpower.
It does. There's a couple issues here. I mean, one is he was the popularly elected, democratically elected leader of the country. This is the person the people of Haiti chose. Now, of course, the election, again, it was not really a fair election in that the most popular party in the country, Famille-Lavalas, was not allowed on the ballot. But as imperfect as it was, the Haitian people overwhelmingly chose this person. So it would have been a double assault on democracy and a double indignity for the foreign powers, the U.S. and others, to remove the democratically elected president by force, simply because they got tired of him, didn't like what he was doing. We know that also from State Department cables made available by WikiLeaks that the Obama administration had really gotten sick of Preval. And the cables are quite disparaging in how he's described. You know, I think you also see some of the racism come through there, and that, you know, he's referred to in ways that you don't see, you certainly wouldn't see many Western heads of state referred to in the same kind of fashion. So, yeah, it was really a double attack on Haiti's democracy.
But the U.S. and other foreigners did succeed in engineering the election that followed, the one that put Martelly in power.
Yeah, and this is directly related to the same dynamic between the U.S. and Preval, in that it was Preval's, his party's candidate, Jude Celestin, who, according to the official results, was going to be headed into the runoff. You know, Haiti has a runoff election process. If you don't get a certain number of votes in the first round, there isn't a clear winner, you know, overwhelming winner in the first round. It proceeds to a runoff with the two top candidates. Not an uncommon electoral system. So, according to the official results, Celestin, Preval's candidate, was headed to the runoff along with Marlon Monegat, who's a conservative former first lady from one of the post-coup regimes after Aristide was ousted the first time. And so, again, you know, Lavalas being kept off the ballot, people's will not truly being expressed here, but you had some choice, at least among the political spectrum, left to right, with those two candidates. But what ended up happening was the Organization of American States, led by the United States, France, and Canada, again, you know, your traditional torturers of Haiti, as Noam Chomsky calls them, intervened through the OAS. They sent a special expert mission down there to look at the results of the elections in the first round. We did a statistical analysis of their report, and we found that their conclusions were completely arbitrary. What were their conclusions? Well, they concluded that Celestin should not proceed to the second round, but Michel Martelly should. You know, again, there was no statistical basis for them to make this decision. In fact, one of the American members of this expert commission said as much, but they continued to defend these conclusions. And so that's what ended up happening. You had then two conservative candidates, Martelly and Monegat, go into the runoff, and Martelly ended up being elected by less than 17% of the electorate.
So now here we are 4 years later. Is there any democratic light on the horizon in Haiti?
Well, there is whenever the people's will can be expressed. You know, unfortunately, at the current moment, Fermi Lavalas is still excluded from elections as far as we can see. There's not really any indication that they're going to be allowed on the ballot in the upcoming elections. Hopefully they will be. These elections, by the way, have been delayed for something like 2 years now, you know, which is another part of the problem. Even you have the U.S. and the UN publicly calling for these elections, and also mouthpieces in the U.S. media that are very sympathetic to U.S. foreign policy, such as the Washington Post the other day in an editorial calling for the Haitian government to hurry up and have these elections, you know, since they're so overdue. But this is another case where, through processes in Haiti on the ground, whether influenced by foreign powers or not, also democracy is under attack through this kind of delayed electoral process and other problems. And so, you know, the Haitian people continue to be disenfranchised. They haven't had a chance since this OAS, you know, U.S.-led intervention to overturn the elections last time. They haven't had a chance to elect legislators who might challenge the Martelly administration and provide a check on what it's doing. And, you know, by the way, I mean, it might be worth reminding your listeners that, among other things, Martelly has been very sympathetic to the idea of reconstituting the Haitian army. Of course, your listeners will know that the Haitian army historically has been used as a weapon against the Haitian people, and that there's a number of former paramilitaries and former Duvaliers who are very much looking forward and hoping and lobbying and demonstrating for the reconstitution of this Haitian army. Of course, we also know that Martelly himself has admitted to being a former Tonton Macout. So there's some very disturbing questions about Haiti's future underway, and these are just some of the more blatant examples. I mean, of course, there's all the economic questions that are ongoing and situations that have arisen out of the earthquake, where you still have hundreds of thousands of people in IDP camps, hundreds of thousands of other people still displaced, made homeless, a lot of them forcibly evicted. We've seen essentially a policy of forced eviction. These are the people that the world, their hearts went out to so strongly and publicly and so on after the 2010 earthquake. And these are the same people that Martelly, through his policies, you know, Haitian police go in and forcibly evict these people, and they're still homeless. So, you know, there's so many important issues underway in Haiti right now. And for the Haitian people to be deprived of an opportunity to choose who's going to represent them and handle these big decisions, it's really atrocious.
And Haitian patriots might say that any agreements that the previous governments might have signed with foreign corporations regarding resources should not be in effect, are in fact illegitimate.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's that question too. I mean, to what extent have the Haitian people really had anyone representing them that have made so many of these important decisions in recent years? I mean, before Préval, you know, if you had this interim government that was really a dictatorship imposed on Haiti by Washington, headed by Gerard Latortue, and it carried out a really systematic and brutal killing of thousands of people, imprisonment of many others, blatant political persecution of Famille Lavalas and other popular movements and parties and so on. And so these were the leaders that made some of these decisions at the time. And then you've had the Martelly government, certainly not brought to office in any sort of a democratic fashion, continue to make these kinds of deals with different foreign companies and governments and so on. I mean, the Caracol Industrial Park, for example, you know, it's supposed to be the jewel and the crown of this Clinton, Hillary and Bill Clinton-led development plan for Haiti. It's actually a plan that goes back way before the earthquake. And it's basically a model that's been tried in Haiti before and you know, with very limited results. This is kind of the sweatshop model of development where low-paid Haitian workers are basically working without any real rights are supposed to somehow help Haiti economically develop. Well, that's a really problematic idea on its face. But, you know, even worse is that this was tried under Duvalier, and the result was Cité Soleil, the biggest slum in Haiti and what's supposed to be really the most impoverished slum in the Western Hemisphere. This arose out of the situation where these workers weren't able to provide for themselves or their families anymore. The jobs dried up. We're already seeing a similar situation with Caracol, where they have far fewer investors in that project, people that want to source labor there than they had said they would, and far fewer jobs going to Haitians in that park than they had said there would be as well.
A U.S. judge threw out charges against Indian diplomat Devyani Kobragati, whose New York arrest and strip search sparked a diplomatic rift between Washington and New Delhi. U.S. District Court Judge Shira Scheindlin from New York's Southern District dismissed the indictment Wednesday on grounds that Kobragati had been granted full diplomatic immunity in January. In her decision, Scheindlin wrote, quote, "Even if Kobragati had no immunity at the time of her arrest and has none now, her acquisition of immunity during the pendency of proceedings mandates dismissal," closed quote. Kobragati was arrested December 12th outside her children's New York school. She was accused of submitting a fraudulent visa application for her housekeeper from India. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.